This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I talk to Richard Bausch about his latest book, The Fate of Others. A new book by Richard Bausch is a cause for celebration. He's authored some 24 books, yet a new offering from him is not to be taken for granted. It's a reason to feel fortunate. The Fate of Others is his latest collection of stories. It's actually 10 stories and 2 novellas. In 2025, what can it mean to write about ordinary lives when our world has changed, when we are still trying to recover from the pandemic, when whiplash is the reaction of the day as systems, processes, structures change virtually overnight, institutions are eroded, inequalities exacerbated? The idea that readers can open up a book and enter other worlds, read about the fate of others, and learn about themselves seems miraculous. Richard Bausch's stories explore isolation and losses, but also passions and the things that can remain hopeful and life-giving, even in the worst of times, globally or in our own small moments. As large a gift as this book is to readers, is this wide-ranging conversation with Richard Bausch for the listeners of this podcast. Here now, my conversation with Richard Bausch. Well, Richard, I want to talk to you about The Fate of Others. I did my homework, but is it 13 novels and 9 story collections now? What is it? What are we up to?
13 novels, 1 volume of poems and prose, and 10 volumes of stories. It's 24 books.
Incredible. Let's talk about this story collection, The Fate of Others. This is a large volume. It's 10 stories and 2 novellas. Tell me about this book, these stories, these novellas. Tell me about this book. When people say to you, oh, The Fate of Others, what's it about? What's it all about? What do you say?
Well, I used to, when people would ask me what I write about, I would just say drunkenness, madness, lunacy, and sorrow. And it was something I heard John Irving say when I was at Iowa, and it struck me as being just the way, you know, to characterize what, always writing about trouble. It's always about trouble. There is no fiction if there is no trouble. And of course, trouble is where we live. It's the soup we all live in. And so writing stories just seemed like the natural. I remember when I made up this decision, it was 1970. I was singing and playing in a band and stuff. And I finally said, you know what, I'm going to write stories. I'm tired of this. I'm not very good at it. I play guitar, but never was very good at it. And I wrote songs, and that was, you know, it's maybe 4 songs that I can still remember how to do. And I just said, I'm going to start writing stories. And I don't really, it was almost a, it's like an arbitrary decision. And all of it, truly, that all of it was to avoid having to work 9 to 5. I had a terror of it. And I was willing to try anything. I mean, I did some acting. I could always draw. I just, when I went to college, it was to just delay for 4 more years doing 9 to 5. And I was very lucky. And, you know, thank God I had some talent. So, but I remember saying I wanted to write like Henry James, you know, I wanted to write thick, cool stories that had all these marvelous turns in them. And I still love James. I still read in James. And Chekhov, of course, he's the godfather of us all. He really is.
Well, tell me about this trouble. I mean, trouble, loss, loneliness. There's a lot here in this book about loneliness and isolation. I'm such a fan of yours. I'm also a fan of Frank O'Connor, and his seminal book, The Lonely Voice, is a book I always look at and follow this idea that all stories are about loss and that stories are about what he calls these submerged populations. But I wonder about this idea about trouble and loneliness in your stories, in The Fate of Others. Maybe if we take a story like The Widow's Tale, and this idea of loneliness, I think is, there's something so universal in that story and the interplay of these characters. Some characters know each other very well or are related, and some characters are strangers to each other. And yet the center of everything is this idea of loneliness. I wonder if you can talk about that as a kind of trouble.
You know, it's interesting. I don't really think in terms of any themes when I'm writing. I'm just trying to get, I mean, it always occurs to me in terms of something. I can't remember. It might have been Frank O'Connor who said it today. Something's the matter, and you have to write about it. I love when he said, "I never trust a story until it stands up and tells me to go to hell." I really write for the surprises. That story, The Widow's Tale, really began with an urge to bring people to a scene where an exchange I saw happen. And I used to be involved with the Penn Faulkner Award after they nominated me a couple of times. And I lived in DC, in Virginia, right outside DC, and I was at a gala for Saul Bellow, who was one of the first or either the first or second winner of the Penn Malamud Award for short fiction. And now you can't print the name, but Bellow was sitting at a table with his seventh wife, and she was very young, and this kindly woman across the way just wanting to include her because everybody was talking, of course, to Bellow and over her and stuff, just said, "Do you write too?" And she said, "Oh no." And I used to do ballet, and then the person said, "Do you travel with your grandfather often?" And it was, she sat up and said, "I'm Mrs. Bellow," at the top of her lungs. And it was a little, Bellow looked at her and said, "Calm down, honey. That's what it looks like." But I just thought it was really funny, and I knew I'd write about it at some point. So it just started with that. And then all the rest of it is the surprises. I mean, I had no idea it was going to be about seances or anything like that. I went and looked up seances so I could have some accuracy in the seance. I didn't even know there was going to be a seance. And then I began to know that it, as I'm writing it, that the grief, I had recent grief, and I knew what that felt like. So I'm sure that got in there because of that. I mean, when she's going around saying, her dead husband's name, I'm still going around going, "Oh, Bobby, I mean, I lost my brother in 2018." So I think it was out of that. The two novellas, all the stories that they were written, it was always a discipline for me that, and I never thought of it as anything but that. It's just, you get up and you do your work, and usually I felt like I hadn't done enough, and I was always, thinking about it as this got to do this day's work. But after I lost Bobby, and there was, it was quickly followed by the pandemic, but it was really the loss of Bobby that it, writing became a refuge. I was doing it all day. I mean, I was writing Playhouse, which I was only about halfway through, and I was writing all the stories. And so instead of writing 2 to 3 strict hours where I used to have an alarm clock that would let me know when it was 2 hours so I could quit. And I used to say glibly, I don't like writing. I like to have written, which is what Flannery O'Connor, I think, said once. But anyway, it became a real refuge, a place where I could go, and it was a world I was at least minimally in control of. I don't want to be completely in control of it, or else it becomes, just an exercise in some sort of intellectual exercise. And that isn't for me what it's about at all. It's about opening yourself up to the surprises.
It's not about discipline. It's about you're not going to say, I'm going to get up today and I'm going to write for 2 hours. You just have this need to go in there and do it. I feel like it's, I hadn't thought of this before while reading the story, but I feel it like it's a little bit like you're entering into some kind of a seance yourself.
What a cool way to put that.
Yeah, just something you said made me think that. You know, you mentioned the novellas, and I had to search for it, but I found it. I remembered that William Gassett said something about novellas in response to a question about what he would be working on once The Tunnel, which is like 650 pages or something, after working on that for 26 years, was out in the world. And he said, and I wrote this down, I should like to return to my real love, the novella. I think that is what I should have been doing all along. And he called them storyless stories.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, what do you think about novellas?
Well, I love Henry James's thing, the blessed nouvelle, he called it. There's just something I've written about four of them now, or maybe five. There's one in Spirits in my first book of stories is a novella. Then Rare and Endangered Species is a novella that there's stories around. To me, it's what Peter Taylor said to me once. I think of it as an evening's entertainment. And then he paused and said, superior entertainment too. And I'm not talking about my work, he said. I'm talking about the thing itself. A good long short story is superior entertainment. And what it really is active entertainment. And we live in an age, and we've all our lives, it's long ago past, of passive entertainment. And that's really television, somewhat film, especially now because film is on television now. You don't have to go out to a theater. You don't have to do anything. Switch a channel and you're there and it's washing over you. And I'm not denigrating it. It's beautiful, some of it. It's wonderful. I love, Lisa and I will say, what do we watch tonight? And we'll, find these marvelous, some of the best writing in the world is going on TV right now. But there is something so beautifully contemplative and sweet about the active pleasure of reading a story. And you, to me, it's renewed every single time. I mean, I've read The Great Gatsby, I know at least 40 times. And I even put her in, I put a line of his in, I love the line in The Widow's Tale.
Yes.
The woman reminded her of the line in Gatsby. She was shrill, languid, handsome, and horrible. That's such a great line.
Is such a great line. And when I read that, I thought, I wondered how long has Richard Bausch been carrying this line and just waiting, and it fits so perfectly. Well, let me ask you about Hemingway then. And can we talk about him in that time as well, where there's a young boy who meets Ernest Hemingway, and indeed Hemingway buys him breakfast. And the boy is, I mean, the boy is something of an open book, or at least Hemingway can perceive that the boy is in a tough situation as regards something, and it turns out it's his situation with his father and his stepmother. And I was struck by the ways that you mention many writers here in this book, including Hemingway, for example, in the story and in Widow's Tale. And there are people in your stories who love literature and writing and art, as in The Fate of Others, say, for instance. So may I ask you about this too, this element that's in your work and just in our conversation, how you go to quote Peter Taylor and others. I've considered though how these people are familiar to us in some way. It's not so out of context, and you sort of bring them to the fore to us. What do they mean to you that they're integrated in these stories and this idea that these characters love to read and they love art?
You know, I don't, I think it's just, it may be in a way where I am as a just going through, life, where I'm more and more, and not surprisingly, of course, I mean, I'm just more and more nostalgic about so many things that I've loved. I mean, for instance, in The Fate of Others, James Dickey is mentioned, and the only reason he's mentioned is because he is Thomas Fearing. And I didn't want to offend anybody that knew Jim and loved him to think I was parodying him or making fun. I really wasn't. It's the father in there, Thomas Fearing, is sad a lot and is a great poet and all the rest of it. But and of course, I put on Mr. Dickey, who was a good friend, and I think he would laugh. Several instances, and Mr. Dickey never did at all, but people that we knew did, like pissing into the fountain and stuff like that. That wasn't Jimbo. That was a guy named Harry Cruz, who was just crazy. And he was also fun to be around, but crazy. You wouldn't want to be with him after he'd had more than he should. But anyway, it could be just that, but I don't know. Because, I'm not so conscious of any of it. It's like I'm just sort of setting it into motion and then seeing what takes place and trying to. The only thing I'm really doing in every instance consciously is trying to be clear. In other words, if there's a, well, you know what I mean, or you're a writer, if there's a image in my head, I want it to be in the reader's head exactly as I see it. And that's the only reason I'm using whatever similes or, metaphors I use, is to get it right, just to get it exact. And I mean, it's the thing I've always loved about Tolstoy. It's why I've read War and Peace. I'm reading it now for the sixth time, because it's these things, these moments, the Natasha at her first ball, he says she was at that pitch of happiness where it is impossible to imagine an ungenerous thought in another person. And you just go, oh my God, geez, I know that feeling. That's an exact description of that feeling. And then, later on at Borodino, there's Pierre, two men are blown up, and he has this thought, this is the beginning of the battle. Surely now they'll stop. That kind of thing, where there's this, or Nikolai saying, why do they want to kill me? I'm such a fine fellow. My mother loves me. And that's what I look for in reading. So when I'm writing, I try to come to those moments where, when the moments come that I'm, dreaming up, my favorite expression when people say I'm a realist, I say, no. And then I quote Marianne Moore. I say, I'm making imaginary gardens with real toads in them.
That's so good.
You know that? Oh, that love, it's called the poem is called Poetry, and the opening line is, I too dislike it. She was amazing.
Yeah. Well, I watched this video the other day where the Mexican director Guillermo del Toro is saying that humanity is in the middle of a massive cosmic tantrum. And he said, there is such a rage, and compulsively, when you're in a tantrum, you avoid dialogue. And he said, the only thing that can save us is a dialogue with the darker part of ourselves. He was defending movies about monsters, and he used the word weirdness, but mostly, I think he was underscoring extremely flawed characters. And he said, imagination is empathy, and we empty ourselves into something that is not accessible when we are open to this idea of trying to communicate in this cosmic tantrum where we feel like we have no language, but we have to say something. And it made me think about, when I saw that video, I was in the middle of reading The Fate of Others. And, I always conflate things when I'm reading a book. I conflate things with other things with the book. I wondered about this. I said, I think I'm going to ask Richard Bausch about Guillermo del Toro. This idea of being all of us collectively in this terrible space. Because another thing he said, and he said it in Spanish, but I'll translate and just paraphrase it. He said, we're at the end of something right now. I don't know what's ending, but something is ending, he said. And we're not going to know for a couple of decades exactly what has been lost. He said, the world is in its last gasps. He said, if the pandemic didn't humble you, nothing will. When you are in an accident, in a car accident, it takes you a little while, about 3 minutes or so, where you are disoriented and trying to realize the fullness of what just occurred. At the cosmic level, that is where we are collectively. I believe that we have crashed, he said. We are in those moments after the crash where we are so disoriented and looking around and trying to figure out what just happened. And after 3 minutes, we're going to open our eyes and say, how did we get here? So,
That's amazing.
yeah. And so I was thinking about your stories and these characters who are dealing even with a personal tragedy, the death of a husband, say, or something else, your grown child's addiction or something else. I don't know. I mean, in the context of 2025, to read the fate of others, in the context of what's happening in our world, I'm reading Richard Bausch and I'm thinking about these things that Guillermo del Toro said. What do you think about that?
I think that's astounding. And I think you're incredibly eloquent to describe it that way. I don't know. I'll tell you briefly the way it is for me. Every morning I would drop my son Paul off at school. He was a half day, and he would have to go over there at noon. And he was very small, quick-eyed, and funny, very funny. I mean, at 5, he came in the kitchen on his belly going, "Agua," because he was thirsty, made me laugh. He just always had this great sense of humor, but I worried about him because he was also very easily hurt. And I would watch him go in, and the door would shut, and I would drive back. And, I was teaching at George Mason. I had days free because I was teaching only at night, a couple days a week. Anyway, I had this feeling of grief because he was going to be in there for 6 hours and got way out of my ability to protect him or stop anybody from hurting him. So I wrote a story called What Feels Like the World that was about that, I thought. And this is how this happens for me. The story got published in The Atlantic, and it was an O. Henry Prize story. And the poet Roland Flynn asked me to come visit a class and talk about it and answer questions and stuff. And he led a discussion about the story, and he said, "This story is soaked in grief. It's about grief." And he said, "And the wonderful symbol of it is the vaulting horse, the thing you can't get over," because the story was about a girl who couldn't get over the only girl in fifth grade who couldn't get over the vaulting horse. It opens with her grandfather looking out the window at her practicing in the lawn. When I started writing it, it was the father, and they were divorced, but then I was trying to account for the mom. Where is she? And I had a scene where the divorce happens. Oh, no, this is not about, I'm not writing about divorce, damn it. I mean, it took me a couple of months to realize that it's about that feeling of helplessness watching the child go into school. So the mother's dead in an auto accident, and the grandfather is with the girl, and it's been a year. But I had no notion that what I was really writing about was grief until Roland Flint said that and said, "The vaulting horse, the thing you can't get over." And I remember thinking, "God damn, that's what it's about." And that it's already in the O. Henry. I didn't know that though. I mean, it was finally thrilling because I realized the secret is just to be clear, to write as clearly as you can and let it take care of itself. And then there's Mary Lee Settle saying to me, she used to call me Sweetness. She said, "Oh, Sweetness, just visit it every day. Let it know you're there, you know." I feel as if I learned something about where we are more than about writing fiction from what you just gave me, and thank you for it. That's astounding. And when you think of the Holocaust as part of all that, we're still recovering from that, and we have these hangovers from it going on that are still happening, you know. So yeah, I hope that's a good answer
A
for
great
you.
answer. And I'm one of those people who follows you on Facebook and picks up these little bits of wisdom from the posts that you share sometimes. But I think about how I love short stories. They are my favorite thing to read, I think. And I always think about how we are such mysteries to each other, and we carry around dark secrets, and most times we can't even begin to understand our motivations. And I think that's what I love about what the stories can mirror back somehow. There's resonance or something. And I think that's the easy part of existing in our world. It just seems to me that because this idea of loss and isolation and everything that we've talked about today is part of the human condition. When you mix in a very violent society, the intolerance that surrounds us, that you frequently have written about on social media, the noise and the chaos of social media itself, access to drugs, lack of access to other things, the easy lies of everyone from the president to fake journalists, false promises and scary potential of things like AI. We are in a tough spot in this world, aren't we?
Think about where it's come from. Imagine Thomas More was willing to die rather than tell one lie. All he had to do was say, yes, fine. And his family says, you know,
yes,
just tell the lie. And he can't do it because he knew where he left off and the rest of the world began, and he simply wouldn't violate that. And it's so hard now to imagine anybody, you know, the world is so, so full of lies that you know, truth seems to have just, I don't know, become something like grass. It's just, you walk on it, and it's not anything you have to worry or think about. But I always think of more because of that. I mean, that's what Robert Bolt's talking about, I think, when he's giving us this. There's a place where he says to the friend, is there no place in you that is just, and he says the name, I can't remember the name, Richmond or whatever, that is just Richmond and no, nothing else. He says, I oppose it, not because I oppose it, but because I oppose it. And that could seem like a sin of pride, but there's another place where he says, you know, God made us to serve him wittily in the tangle of our minds. And if I can find a way around this, I'm going to find it. My business is to survive. And it was that important to him. And I think that's gone. It's just completely gone.
Yeah. But as someone, you know, who has sat on your lectures at Sewanee and followed your career, read your books, I know that you are someone who cares so deeply about the world outside of your books. And I, while reading The Fate of Others, I thought, where is Richard Pausch in 2025? What is how it, with the writing of stories in 2025, does feel like a very different world in 2025, in 2024, in 2025, in 2019, in 2018. So I'm wondering how, the fate of others, the fate of others in 2025, how this book enters this space. May seem like a silly question in the face of these giant problems that we're looking at. We don't even recognize our country anymore.
You know, the thing that that you say, I don't know what I think until I see what I say. There was a pass not too long ago, talking to Sam Dunn. I said, you know, it's going to sound like a something involving artifice, but it really just come to me. It just came up. But I said, somebody said, and I always thought it had an element of truth, that if you could introduce everyone in the world to everyone else in the world, war would be a hell of a lot harder to bring about. And then I said, and a good story is indeed the introduction of someone to someone else. And every time you read a story, it is that transaction. Someone is being introduced to someone else in the world. And the amazing thing about it is that in a lot of most instances, in the majority, the great majority of instances, there are two people or however many are in the story. There's the author, and then there's the people the author is making up. And that, what a beautiful thing about us, and it may be the saving thing about us, is that we actually long for the experience of the other. We are capable of feeling great grief for someone who never existed and who is made up by someone else. And I mean, that's our greatest trait. And fiction does that. And so I say, to be somebody worried about, I said to her, forgive me, I said, the fate of others, because fiction is, and I didn't think of this making up the title. The titles just come to me as people say things in the stories. But, you know, fiction is a confrontation with the other. It's the only place where it happens, really, peacefully, where there's no tension. Is that pompous? Probably is.
No, it's not. As you're talking about it, I feel like, man, I didn't think I could love short stories anymore, but I think I will enter them with a little bit even more love now. So, Richard Bausch, I cannot thank you enough for talking to me today. I feel so honored to get a chance to talk to you. Thank you so much.
But you are something, Yvette. I mean, and Lisa said you're going to enjoy this. She's something else.
Oh, no. You both inspire me so much. Richard Bausch is the author of the story collection, The Fate of Others. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.